On this episode of the Fear Me Out podcast, I interview Jeremy Lupertz. Jeremy was a detective in a very small town in Minnesota. He was involved in a situation where two teenagers were murdered by an older fellow, and he did his best to get the person that committed the murders arrested and convicted of first-degree murder, but it was a hugely controversial case in his community. It actually got worldwide attention, and he wrote a book that's coming out in September all about this tale. It's a really fascinating conversation, and I hope you guys really enjoy listening to Jeremy talk about his integrity and how he was able to handle probably one of the worst situations a law enforcement person could face. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. On today's episode, I have the pleasure of interviewing Jeremy Lupertz. Jeremy contacted me through a Facebook group that we both belong to. And he sent me some information about his life and what he does for a living and the fact that he has had to deal with some post-traumatic stress as a result of his career and some of the things he's had to deal with. I'm not going to give away anything because I want Jeremy to talk about it, but man, the story is really something. So I hope everybody enjoys this episode. I want to introduce you, Jeremy. Welcome you to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Dana. I appreciate the invite to your show.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get into the story.
Okay, my name is Jeremy Lupertz. I'm 49 years old. I'm from Little Falls, Minnesota, and I was a deputy sheriff for the Morris County Sheriff's Office for 28 years, currently retired. I was a patrol officer for 15 of those years and a sergeant investigator, the lead investigator for my department for 12 years. During that time, when I was an investigator and as a road deputy, I investigated and handled many, many disturbing calls, many disturbing cases, suicides, more than I ever want to deal with. Homicide cases, homicide investigations, multiple of those, and accidents that resulted in deaths, just a lot of traumatic incidents I dealt with in my job.
So very much the experience that first responders have all around the world and the country, especially.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, in fact, I have literally, we are also, as deputy sheriffs from Morrison County, we are all trained to be deputy coroners too. So we investigate and handle every death that occurs in our county.
Wow. And Jeremy, you come from a very small town in Minnesota, correct?
Yes, in Little Falls. And Little Falls is actually the childhood home of Charles Lindbergh. And
okay.
Yes. If you located right smack dab in the middle of Minnesota. Very beautiful town. We enjoy four seasons year round. We get plenty of snow in the wintertime and lots of cold too.
Wow. Tell us about growing up in a small town in Minnesota and what life was like for you there.
Sure. So we are, there's a lot of rural area in our county. A lot of lakes, a lot of rivers. Grew up learning to go deer hunting and doing some other hunting and fishing. I have an identical twin brother, and incidentally, my identical twin brother and I, when we graduated high school, we both went to law enforcement training. We attended the, it's basically a law enforcement academy through the college up at Hibbing, Minnesota. It's a 2-year program, very intense. Minnesota has a very high standard for the law enforcement officers. And it's mandatory. You have to have a minimum of 2 years of college, a 2 year college degree to be able to get your license to be post-certified in Minnesota to be a law enforcement officer.
Okay.
So my identical twin brother and I both attended that, and we both graduated from it in 1994. Then we both started working for the Morris County Sheriff's Office, starting in the jail. And then in 1995, I was licensed by the sheriff at the time to be a patrol officer. My brother decided to go into the Navy. He tried talking me into going into the Navy. That was a 4 year stint. He was stationed in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
Wow.
But I had just gotten licensed as an officer. I wanted to work. That was my passion in life, was to help people. And I wanted to stay working as an officer. So I stayed, and my brother left and joined the Navy. That was very hard on me. It was very hard on him too, because growing up, my brother and I have always done everything together. We were very, very close. And as you heard, we even decided to go to college together and for the same career. So my brother, Jamie, deciding to leave and go away for 4 years was really extremely hard.
I bet.
Yes. Yes. In fact, we had such a close bond growing up, you know, how people think that are always curious if identical twins can feel each other's pain and emotions and stuff like that. In my opinion, I have to say yes, absolutely. Because I could feel my brother.
That's phenomenal. Wow.
It was. Yes. In fact, we even tried a test one time to see if I could read his mind. And I kid you not. And I asked him to pick a number in his mind, in his head, visualize a number from 1 to 10. And every time he did it, I was able to close my eyes and use my mind to concentrate and see the number he was concentrating on. I got the number right every time.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, it was actually pretty interesting. So even when he was away in the Navy for those 4 years, I would feel his emotions too. I would feel homesick, very homesick, which he felt a lot when he was gone. Wow. He went through a typhoon one time, got seasick for 3 days.
Oh.
Here to find out, during that time, I was at home. I was nauseous and sick to my stomach for 3 days. Here to find out, when he called me, it was over the same time that he was going through this typhoon.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
So really connected to each other on a deep level.
At a very deep level. And we still are to this day. Very close. So after the 4 years, when Jamie got out of the Navy, he came and worked for the same department that I worked for at the Morris County Sheriff's Office. So we were both deputies at the same department. And we worked together for 17 years. And the interesting thing is, we both dealt with the same type of traumatic incidents, same type of traumatic events, because we worked together, you know?
Right.
So we would both be working at these same fatal accidents where you see just gory scenes, suicides, where we would see this absolutely icky, gory, messy incidences. Well, you know, and it's not just the fact of when you're working this job to see this stuff, but it's also your other senses. It's your heightened senses. It's your smell too. Smell has a big thing to do with it, if people don't know that. When you go in and have to investigate a dead body at a scene, the smell is horrendous. And it's very traumatic too, because it's something that I carried on and other officers carried on with them for days and weeks afterwards. Anytime I ate something, it tasted like that dead body to me.
Oh my God. That is just horrific.
It was horrific. And then I would smell that stench of a dead body for weeks afterwards. It's like it just stuck in your nose, stuck in your body. So it was that it's that traumatic. In my opinion, any officer, any person that works as a law enforcement officer, at some point in your career, every officer ends up with some form of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. It's because of everything that we have to deal with. It's all the physical interaction that we have with people. It's also the visual sights that we have to see. It's also the touch, because there's a lot of times I had to, you know, we always had to pick up the dead bodies and put them in the body bags. We had to pick up the parts and pieces. And I had a guy one time that got ran over by a train and both his legs were severed off.
Oh.
And he lived through it. The guy lived through it. But I had to carry his severed legs to the ambulance to ship with him.
Wow. And
stuff like that, that is very, yes, it's very traumatic.
So Jeremy,
now the whole, if you're curious, how do we deal with stuff like that?
Yeah, right? That's a question. I mean, they ask, like, how in the world can you handle this?
I was always able to. And the way I did it is, cops like to use humor. We like to use humor to help deal with the traumatic incidences that we deal with. Humor is a great tool for us to use. So we're always playing jokes on each other. We're always picking at each other and stuff like that. That was a great tool for me. Okay. Another thing, and the biggest way I was able to deal with these matters was my faith. I was born and raised a Catholic, so I'm a Christian, and I have a strong belief in God and Jesus Christ. So my faith was able to get me by with any type of traumatic incident I had to deal with in my life, be it at work or even in my home life. And this case that, so the book that you mentioned that I wrote is called Murder on Elm Street. And this case had such a traumatic effect to my life that it actually ended up wrecking my life. When this case was finally done and over, I ended up, it ended up wrecking my life. I don't want to give it away because it's in my book. Okay. So I don't want to give away how it did, but if you read my book, it describes in detail of how and why it ended up wrecking my life. Yes.
Okay.
And, but because my passion in life is helping people.
Yes.
That's how I endure. That's how I keep moving on with life. That's how I keep going on. You know, I always had a strong faith in God, and I believe that God put me here on earth, and his will for me was to do the will of other people, to help other people. That's what he wanted me to do. And that's what I do. I've helped so many people in my career, and I loved every minute of it.
So, and do you have siblings besides your twin brother?
No, it's just my identical twin brother and me, no other siblings.
Okay. And are your parents still alive?
Yes. Yep. My parents are still alive. In fact, my mom was 16 years old when she had us. And yes, she was very young, and my dad was 19 years old. So it was one of those what you call a shotgun wedding. Have you ever heard that term?
I have, yes. Yeah.
My dad told me that. He said, so I said, you had no choice. Your mom and dad and my mom's mom and dad, my grandma and grandpa, there really was no choice in the matter. You were getting married, right? And dad goes, oh, yeah. We're twins on the way? Yeah. There was no other choice. It was a shotgun wedding.
Well, you know, Jeremy, a lot of times those weddings don't survive for very long. But it sounds like your parents were able to find a way to
hold it together. Absolutely. My folks are still married. They still live in happily together and it's been 50 years now since they've been married.
That's very sweet.
It is. It's very impressive. Oh, yes.
And do you have a family of your own at this point?
I do not. No, I am single. I was married at the time that when I was working, and I ended up dealing with the traumatic case that my book is about. And I ended up actually losing my marriage because of that.
I'm so sorry. And do you have children?
I do. I have one daughter. She was 9 years old at the time the case was going on. Her name is Haley. You know, she's now in college. She's starting her second year of college.
Wow. And I'm hoping that you didn't lose your relationship with her.
Well, because of because of the divorce and her ended up, she ended up moving away to a different part of the state with her mom. So I did, in effect, end up losing my close relationship with my daughter. I had a very close relationship with my daughter. Wow. And I did end up losing a large part of that because she ended up moving away with her mom because I got divorced. Yes.
And did your wife at the time grow up in the same town that you grew up in?
Yes, we were both born and raised in Little Falls. Yeah. So how it ended, my marriage ended up, how I ended up losing my marriage because of the case is because I'll go into a little detail about the case if you'd like.
I would love for you to start at the beginning because I think it's quite a compelling and sure. In some ways amazing and sad story.
So November 23rd, 2012, it was my day off. And my wife is an RN. She's a registered nurse. And it was her day off. So we were both home together, sitting watching TV. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I get a phone call on my cell phone from Deputy David Sherpin. Not uncommon for me to get phone calls. I get them all the time when I was off duty because I was a sergeant, lead investigator for the department. I would get calls for anything, any major cases that came in that they needed help on. So Dave in particular calls me and tells me, he goes, I received a call from William Anderson telling me that his neighbor called him and is looking for assistance in helping him find an attorney. William told him that his neighbor, Byron Smith, has had problems with people breaking into his house and that he might have shot and killed somebody today. And I'm like, wow. Well, it's not uncommon for us to get calls from people that over-exaggerate things too.
Oh, okay.
So I told, but something about this call felt, you know, out of the norm. You know, something was telling me I better go in and assist and help with this case. So I told Officer Sherping I'd get ready. I'd come in to help. Of course, I tell my wife, Chrissy, and she's upset. We finally get a day off together. We've been working long, hard hours. And it was our time to relax. And this has been happening so often where I get this constant interruption from work to either get called in to work, to have to leave while we're having a family function going on. So all these interruptions to my family time is really starting to bother my wife. The life of having to be married to an investigator. It's hard. It's hard on a spouse, very hard because of all the interruptions to my family time.
Right. So
I go into work. I meet with Deputy Sherping and Deputy Madison. So I devise a plan to go over to Smith's house, Byron Smith's house, to see what's going on. Incidentally, Byron Smith lives on Elm Street. So we get to Elm Street. His place is only 5 minutes away from our office. And as I'm driving down Elm Street, I see William Anderson walking down his driveway. So I stop, rolled on my passenger window, and I talked to him. I said, I confirmed with him that he had called, that he said his neighbor, Byron Smith, was being broken into. And I asked him, I said, Bill, he goes by. I said, did Byron actually call you and say that he killed somebody? And he said, no, he didn't actually tell me that. He just said that he wanted help looking for an attorney, and I assumed something major might have happened like that. I said, oh, okay. Well, it made me feel a little bit better, you know? So Deputy Sherping and I drove to Byron's residence, which is at the dead end of Elm Street. He has a long driveway that leads up to a brick Rambler-style house. We pull up to the front door. Dave and I exit our squad cars. We're walking up towards the front door, and I don't know Byron Smith. I never met him before. An older gentleman in his mid-60s comes walking out of the house with his hands raised above his head. That's not common, you know, something common that you run into all the time. In fact, that was a first for me. I never have somebody that I'm going to meet come out of their house with their hands raised above their head like they did something wrong. So that was kind of a red flag for me.
I bet. So, and if I can interrupt you just for a sec, Jeremy, how old were you at this time?
You know, that's a good question. I was probably around 38 years old.
Oh, so, okay. So this happened a while ago.
Yes. This happened, like I said, I got called in on November 23rd, 2012.
Right. Okay. So that we're talking
about, yeah. This is the day of, yep. This was the day of the case.
Okay.
So when I'm looking at Byron, he's got his hands raised above his head. He's got gray hair that's all messy, sticking out to the side. It's all messed up. He's wearing a blue jean jacket and blue jean pants, or these type of jeans. And it looked like he had slept in his clothes. So I asked him, I said, "Hey, Byron, I heard something might have happened at your place. Do you mind if we come in and talk to you about this?" So Byron puts his hand down and invites us into his house. So we get into Byron's house. And as soon as you walk through the door, to the right is the laundry room. To the left is the kitchen. There's a hallway straight in front that leads down to a bathroom, bedrooms, and a living room. And then there's also a stairwell that goes down into the basement. So Byron asks us to follow him down the hallway. He takes us to his bedroom. The door is closed. He opens the door, and it's cold in there. Mind you, there was just 2 inches of fresh snow that fell on the ground.
Okay.
And there's a window broken in this room, and there's glass scattered all over a desktop in there. So it was clear to me that somebody from the outside had broken the window to gain entry into his house.
Right.
Byron tells me his house was broken into yesterday, and it's happened before. So I'm like, oh, okay. He tells me a little bit about the break-in and that. And so now I'm starting to feel like, oh, well, this is just a burglary complaint. I've handled millions of those, you know, so nothing major. We'll get his information and shouldn't take too long, right? So I'm talking to him. He's telling me about these previous burglaries and that he's had. And then we walk back towards the entry door near the stairwell that goes into the basement. And Byron tells me, "There's something else I need to show you in the basement." Just, okay. So we start following him downstairs, Deputy Sherbing and I. Byron's in front of me. And as we're walking down the steps, I see a small spot of blood on the wall. It looks like a small spot of blood on the wall.
And again, if I can interrupt you just for a second, I apologize for interrupting, but was he just acting normal?
He wasn't excited or anything like that. He was rather calm the whole time that we were dealing with him.
Wow.
Not excited. Yeah, it was odd. It was a strange demeanor that he had. It was kind of spooky, really.
Okay.
And he just kept a rather calm, straight voice about himself. So
you're walking down the stairs and you notice what appears to be a small amount of blood?
Yes, on the wall. It looks like a small speck of blood on the wall. And as I'm continuing to walk down, and then I look down and there's a rug at the bottom, a red in color rug. And it looks like there's a spot of blood on the rug too. Well, this is really starting to concern me now. And the hairs on the back of my neck are starting to stand up. So we get to the bottom of the steps, and Byron's still telling me about a previous. Now he's telling me about a previous break-in that had happened. And one of the things I see is to my left, as soon as you get to the bottom of the stairs, there's some bookshelves. And in between two tall bookshelves is a chair. And it's I call it a lazy boy type chair, reddish brown in color. And it's just odd to me because why would somebody set something up like that? It looks like a hiding spot is what it looked like.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And by the chair, I also see a water bottle and some energy bars. Looks like somebody was planning on sitting there for a while. And under the chair, I see a pair of tennis shoes and these are odd because they're a skateboard style type tennis shoe that skateboarders wear, young kids wear, teenagers wear.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I thought, well, why is a 64-year-old have a pair of shoes like that? You know, it's not, you know, not to say that they wouldn't wear something like that, but it's uncommon.
Right.
So as we're standing there and we're talking, he ultimately tells me, yeah, so when they broke in yesterday, I was sitting in my reading chair down here between the bookshelves, reading a book, and I heard the window break. But before that, I heard that somebody walking around my deck, trying the door handles, looking through the windows. I could see the shadow and that, he tells me. So I knew somebody was walking around and maybe thinking about breaking into my place. And then I heard the window break. And then I heard footsteps coming down the hallway. And as the footsteps came down the stairs, he goes, I shot. And he came tumbling down to the bottom of the steps. And I'm just listening to this. I'm like, you shot. I'm like, holy crap. You know, I was just shocked and amazed, really. But I didn't say nothing. I'm sitting here listening to him, letting him tell his story. And he goes, and he fell down to the bottom of the stairs. I had my Mini 14 rifle that I had sitting next to me in the basement. And he goes, I want him dead. So I shot him again in the head.
And he, in the head.
In the head. Yep. And then he goes, I had a tarp nearby. So by the fireplace. So I grabbed the tarp and I wrapped his body in the tarp. He goes, because there was a lot of blood and I didn't want it soaking into the carpet. So I wrapped his body in a tarp and I drug it off into my back office room. I said, wow. I said, okay. And I said, what happened after that? He goes, the blood was just pounding in my ears. I was so distraught and excited. I sat down in my chair and approximately 10 to 11 minutes later, I heard more footsteps. He goes, and the footsteps came down the hallway again. They must have came in through the same window. And I heard the footsteps stopped at the top of the stairs. And then they started coming down the stairs. And when I saw the hips, I shot again. And she came tumbling down the stairs.
It was a female woman.
Party now. And she's laying wounded at the bottom of the stairs. He goes, and I went to shoot again. And there was click. The gun jammed. The gun didn't fire. So she laughed at me, he tells me. She's laughing at me. And so I grabbed my pistol at my side. I pointed at her and I shoot and I shoot and I shoot. I shot her multiple times.
Oh my God.
When she quit moving, when she was dead, I thought she was dead. I grabbed her and I drug her from the bottom of the stairs back into the same room where I laid the boy, and I laid her next to the boy. He goes, but then I noticed that she was still gasping for breath. She was still alive.
Even though he shot her multiple times?
Get this. Then he tells me, he goes, I can't stand to see any animals or people suffer. So I took my gun, I put it under her chin. And I pulled the trigger and gave her a good, clean finishing shot. This is what he tells me. And he's telling me this.
Calm voice,
just straight and calm, spooky. It was very spooky. And so I said, well, at this point, I haven't seen any bodies yet. I just seen some small spots of blood. I'm like, if you shot the guy in the head at the bottom of the stairs, I should be seeing a pile of blood or something and brains or something at the bottom there, and I'm not seeing anything. But what I am seeing is rugs that he had put down that were there. And the spot of blood ultimately that I saw when I was walking down the stairs, that actually soaked through. I later discovered that had soaked through that rug because there was so much of it at the bottom of the stairs. When we later moved the rugs that were laid out there, and here to discover there was brain matter and pieces of brain and skull and blood, and that was coagulated and just gross. Well, here, after he had shot these teenagers, he had laid these rugs over it to cover up the site. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yes. Well, and then he tells me, because I asked Byron, I said, well, Byron, I still haven't seen the bodies yet. So I'm sitting there hoping the whole time, please tell me there's no bodies. Please tell me they're not dead. Please tell me this is just some crazy story this guy's making up. So I asked him, I said, well, Byron, where are the bodies? He said, you said you shot and killed two people. Where are the bodies? He goes, follow me. I'm like, oh boy. He takes me to a room just off from bottom of the steps that leads back to another room. And there's a door closed. And he goes, that's my office workroom back behind that door. The bodies are laying back there.
Wow.
I reach for the door handle. My hands are shaking. I open the door and there lays the bodies of a young boy, a young teenage boy, and a young teenage girl, who we later identified to be the boy was 17-year-old Nicholas Brady. The female party, young female teenager, was 18-year-old Haley Kiefer. They were cousins.
Wow.
And I asked Byron, I said, Byron, when did this happen? He goes, it happened yesterday on Thanksgiving Day, around between noon and 1 o'clock. Wow. I'm like, he was on sitting on these bodies for 24 hours. He had sat on them. I'm like, oh my gosh. And I said, well, Byron, because of what you told me here and because of what happened, I said, I have no choice but to place you under arrest at this time. So I arrested, he goes, I understand. And I know you're just doing your job still, just right. Matter of fact about everything. So anytime I deal with somebody too, I've always had a practice in my career. I treat everybody with kindness and respect, because that's the way I'd want to be treated, no matter what anybody ever did. I don't care how serious their crime was. I always treated them with kindness, understanding, and respect, because that's the way I would want to be treated.
Okay.
And it's paid off in the long run many a times. I've been able to get so many confessions from people because of the way I treat them. I kill them with kindness, and it goes a long way. I created a big rapport with him. You kind of get into their mental psyche a little bit when you do that. They feel that they can trust you.
Right.
So then I place them under arrest, and I call the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and my sheriff. So the BCA is a state law enforcement agency. They're the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. What they do is they come out and they assist us with processing the scene. They have all the technical analysts that can do the DNA testing, do the fingerprint testing to identify the people. They do all the technical stuff, and because they have the lab technicians that can test the evidence and then testify to it. Okay, that's why we use them. They come out and they assist us in our cases. They don't take over the cases. We are the lead in it. So they're a great agency to help us out. Most states have those type of resources. So in ours in particular is the BCA. So I have them get them to come out. And then later through my investigation, what I discovered was Byron had parked his pickup truck away from his house, a quarter mile away, to make it look like he wasn't home. Byron's whole intent was he wanted to catch whoever was breaking into his house, and he wanted his revenge.
Again, is it common in such a small town to have this kind of...
Good question. And the answer is no, this is not common. This was very out of the norm. We are a nice, small community. Most people know each other. And this was very out of the normal. So it was a very odd, very weird case to have to investigate. It was a first for me, and in fact it was a first for our department to have to investigate such a case like that.
Wow.
Especially the death of two teenagers. So I was able to obtain three separate statements from Byron in this case.
Okay.
The third one in particular I obtained even after he had talked to an attorney when he was in jail. So this is what I was getting at why I treat people the way I do. I kill them with kindness so that I can build up a rapport for them enough to be able to trust me and get them to talk to me. Byron wanted to tell his side of the story in this matter. And thank goodness he did, because during that statement, I was able to get his whole state of mind, his whole, almost his whole state of mind of what he did. And one of the things he told me of why he shot and killed these teenagers is because when he was younger, Byron was single. He was not married, lived alone at home. In fact, he lived in his mother had just passed away, and he was living with his mother and in the family home that they had for years. So he grew up in this home.
Wow.
Yeah. He was a very odd character. I mean, I just have to say, I don't like to judge people, but I'm just telling you what, I observed with him. He wasn't like most people that I met or dealt with. He just had an odd demeanor about himself. Byron worked for a state department for like Department of Homeland Security, installing surveillance systems in embassies.
Wow.
Yes. And he had been in the military service. So when I interviewed him, I asked him, I said, I was curious. I said, Byron, did you ever have to shoot and kill anybody when you were in the service? And his answer was no, he never did. So this was a first for him to ever shoot and kill somebody. And during my conversation, he in particular seemed to have more of a hatred towards the female party. That was very interesting and intriguing because he had, for some reason, he had this hatred towards the female. Wow. And he thought the female he shot and killed was his neighbor right next door, Ashley Williams.
Oh.
And here to find out, it was not. For some reason, he hated the Williams family. Him and Bill Anderson did not like the Williams family at all. They had a hatred toward them for some reason. And that's who he thought the female was, who he shot and killed. And during the statement too, I asked him, I said, well, how come you didn't call law enforcement to report this incident when it happened? His answer to me was, well, my day was screwed up. He goes, I didn't want to screw up your Thanksgiving day. I'm like, are you kidding me?
This is so bizarre.
And I was working on the day. I was working Thanksgiving Day when he shot and killed those people. I would have been grateful if he would have called when it happened. But because of what he didn't do, and he never called law enforcement to report the incident.
You guys went there because somebody else called you, right?
Exactly. His neighbor, he talked to Bill Anderson, who he was, he asked Bill to try and help him find an attorney. He never had him call law enforcement or anything. He never called law enforcement. His neighbor didn't. This is what incidentally got us because of this. So it was a suspicious activity complaint is the way I classified it, the way we got the call that turned into a double homicide, a double murder case. Yeah. Through the investigation. Yes. From seeing those dead bodies, those poor young teenagers, and I have a daughter at home. When I got done investigating the scene and doing statements with Byron at about around 4:30 in the morning, I finally got that part wrapped up. When I got home to get a couple hours rest before I went back in to continue the investigation again, I laid in bed. First thing I did when I got home is I checked in on my daughter. Her bedroom was right next to ours. Yeah. And she was laying there sleeping, and I had tears in my eyes because, you know, it's like, thank God my daughter's home safe, but somebody's parents out there their young daughter is not going to be coming home ever again. And it just made me very sad.
And it was not your job necessarily to reach out to the parents of the people that you discovered that were dead, the teenagers.
Oh, that is correct. So after I took the first and second statement from Byron, I was at the office. We received a phone call because we still at that time had no idea who these teenagers were. We received a phone call from the parents saying our son and our son and daughter, their cousins, didn't show up for Thanksgiving dinner yesterday. And we haven't heard from them. We've been trying to reach them on their cell phones and we can't get a hold of them. That's how we discovered who the teenagers were that he shot and killed.
Oh my God!
They described who a description of them, and it matched with the teenagers that were laying in Byron's basement. Yes.
And this was all information that you took over the phone with the parents, or no? Somebody else?
Somebody else did. Yep. Okay. So once we got the information, then we were able to piece the puzzle together on who these teenagers were, and I get them identified. We have a chaplain that works at the sheriff's office, Chaplain Greg Valentine, a wonderful man. And I was so, when I first started years ago, we didn't have a chaplain and we had to do all the death notifications to the families. It's so heart-wrenching to do that. Many a times I've had them just break down in front of me and of course, why wouldn't they? They're just distraught and crying. And I've had to give many death notifications throughout the years. It's never a pleasant thing to do. So when we finally got a chaplain for the sheriff's office, he would go out and assist us or go out on his own to give the death notifications to the family. It was so nice to have him along. I loved having that interaction with, somebody close, a pastor to be able to, you know, console the family members while I'm talking with them and while I'm at these scenes. He basically, our chaplain was a godsend in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yes. So what I was getting at earlier is when I got home, when I had talked to my checked in on my daughter, then I went and I took my equipment off and I laid in bed. I was married at the time. My wife was in bed sleeping. And I laid next to her and I was exhausted. I was ready to, from being up so late from working so long. But yet my mind was racing from everything that I just saw and what I had to do. And I closed my eyes trying to fall asleep. When I closed my eyes, I saw flashes of Nick Brady and Haley Kiefer, the two dead teen cousins that I had just witnessed. When I had saw Nicholas, he had been shot in the head, and I could see pieces. I could see his brains. That's how traumatic the scene was. And Haley Kiefer was shot in one of her eyes, and she was shot under the chin, in the chest, riddled with bullets. Very traumatic thing to see. I saw their dead bodies when I closed my eyes to try to fall asleep.
Oh, Jeremy, yeah. This is a horrible story. My God.
And then while I'm laying there, and then I could smell their dead body. So it's not just of what you saw. It's also what, you know, the other senses, you're smelling that too. And what I did to try to fall asleep with those type of images flashing in your mind.
No way.
Opened my eyes and I stared into the dark.
Yeah.
What I did to help me is because of my faith that really helps me in these matters. I tried to picture a bright light that would grow through my whole body. I was trying to enlighten my spirit. And because of that, I was actually able to calm down enough when, with God's good grace and help, I was able to finally fall asleep. Okay. So my faith is what helped me the most when going through these traumatic events.
Right. So what happens next? We still have about 20 minutes left. So I'm curious about how things progress from here.
Sure. So from there, I did a search warrant, of course, of the house. And one of the things Byron did not tell us, one of the things that I found was So after I got done doing the interviews with Byron, I went back to the house. The BCA had already started and was doing the search warrant to collect the evidence. And I went back to assist them. They were getting close to finishing up. So while we're there, I'm looking in the office workroom where the bodies were found. I find a digital handheld recorder that's laying on top of a desk near where the bodies were. So I pick it up and I'm looking at it and I'm like, the batteries are dead and it's not working. So I showed it to the lead BCA agent, Chad Musaeus, that was working with us on this. And I said, did you guys see this recorder? And he goes, yeah. He goes, I saw the same exact type of recorder in the bookshelf, sitting in the bookshelf above the reading chair where Byron had been sitting before these teenagers broke in. He goes, but I checked it. He goes, the batteries are dead on it. And it looks like it's been sitting there a while. It's not working. I said, I want both these recorders. I want you to take these and I want these analyzed. I said, I want to see if there's anything on them. And he's like, well, no, we're not going to do that. I said, what do you mean? No. He goes, well, the batteries are dead on them. It looks like they've been sitting there a while. We're not going to get anything on these. I had this gut feeling that there might be something on him because I knew that he installed surveillance systems in embassies.
Right.
So I just had this feeling, maybe there's something on him and I want him checked. So I had to argue with the lead BCA agent and I was very adamant. I said, no, I said, this, I'm the lead investigator in this. I want these taken and I want them analyzed and checked. And he reluctantly finally agreed to take them and have them analyzed. What we found out is that recorder that was found, batteries were dead on it, in the bookshelf above that reading chair, was the holy grail piece of evidence in the case. Oh. That recorder had been working. And what we discovered was Byron Smith had monologued before the teenagers broke in. What he was going to do if somebody did break into his house and he had to shoot and kill them. He was saying things about, Bruce, this is Byron. Bruce was his brother. He was telling Bruce, that something major just happened. I need you to come to the residence here. Park about a block away and then walk to the house from this direction. And then he's acting like he's talking about calling an attorney and what he's going to say to an attorney regarding it. And mind you, this is all before the teenagers even broke in.
And so this was premeditated on his part.
Absolutely. This is how we were between his statements that I took from him and this recording that we found, we proved premeditation. He had this whole thing planned and set up that if anybody was going to break into his house, he was going to shoot and kill them. He was going to get his revenge for what was happening.
And how did the community respond to all of this?
Oh, that is a big traumatic part for me. How did they respond? I had half the community believing that Byron had the legal right to shoot and kill these two teenagers because he was defending his home. I had the other half of the community that were on my side because I had arrested Byron and he got charged for two counts of first degree murder in this case.
Oh, okay.
So I had half the community on my side, half the community against me. And it's like, well, yes, I was the lead investigator in the case. Yes, I'm the one that discovered all this stuff and arrested Byron and got his statements and that. And he got charged for the murder of these two teenagers. But I'm not the one that charged him. I'm not the one that does that. That's the county attorney's office. I'm just a fact gatherer in the case. I gather all the facts and present it to see if there's enough evidence for him to be charged. So
half the town crucified you.
Half the town crucified me. Half the county was crucifying me. So the news media caught wind of this case and they jumped all over it. This case went national news all over the country. In fact, all over the world, because we had news reporters. We had news reporters from Australia even that came to watch this case.
Wow.
Yes.
And so how did you handle the stress of people, considering that you devoted your life to the care and the service of others, come after you as a criminal yourself, I guess, in a way?
Yes, because what I discovered and how it was so traumatic to not just me, but also my family and even my brother, because my identical twin brother, Jamie Luberts, sure. He was a deputy also at the same time, and he had involvement in this case because he was the deputy that investigated his first previous burglary that he reported in October. Okay. So that's how my brother had involvement, yes. So during this, I had certain members of the community. They started a coalition called the Byron Smith Coalition Fund, and they were trying to get money to help support Byron's defense. Wow. So they had their meetings at the VFW in town. And of course, William Anderson was on this committee, along with some other neighbors of Byron's, Kathy and John Lang. So they started this, and somebody had to have given out my brother's and mine address, because we actually incidentally lived next door to each other too.
They exposed your identity and
exposed where we were. And every time most of the time when this meeting would get done, we had a parade of cars driving by our residence to harass us. I also found a vehicle when I got off work one night. I was sitting at the kitchen table looking out my window. I saw a vehicle parked in the alleyway across the street behind a house. And I could see a male party sitting there with a pair of binoculars looking towards my house.
Oh my God.
I've had this, I've handled calls like this before in the past. And what I usually discovered, it was a private investigator that was usually hired to watch a residence. And that's what it looked like to me. I shut my window shade. I called my dispatch and asked for one of the local Little Falls police officers to go check it out. He went and checked out the vehicle, and sure as heck, it was a private investigator. Wow. And normally when they're discovered or when they're pointed out, they usually leave, and then he left the area. Well, I figured out that what I assume is that it was a private investigator hired by the defense for Byron Smith to try to catch me and my brother doing something wrong so that they could, when we had the trial coming up, to make it look like you know, try to discredit us is what, that's the word I was looking for.
So Jeremy, how did you handle the disillusionment that would go along with you knowing you were doing the right thing and knowing that there was something terribly wrong with the person that killed these young kids? And that, I just can't even imagine how you would hang on to your faith and your, and to be able to, you know, function under these circumstances.
That's a great question, because my wife was so distraught over all the harassment we were getting. She was even hearing it at work from other people. My faith is so strong that it can never be broken, no matter what.
Okay.
But, and one of the things too is, you know, you hear about officer suicides from all the traumatic things that we deal with in our career. And that,
absolutely.
That I can honestly say that would never happen with me. And why? It's because I've been to many, many suicide cases.
Right, right.
And I see, in my opinion, it's just my opinion, but I think suicide is a very selfish act.
Okay.
Because I always had to deal with and see the trauma left behind because of what this person chose to do.
Right.
And all it does is hurt their loved ones and family members that they left behind, and they have to pick up the pieces and deal with it. So that's why I see it as a very selfish act.
Okay. So again, because we're running a tiny bit short on time, how does this come to some sort of conclusion based on the fact that everybody's divided and you're
getting harassed? Because of all the harassment, because of the division in my community and that, I ended up having to sell my house to try to keep my marriage. Wow. I moved out of town, out into the county to get away from so people wouldn't know where I was at. So that, because my wife was to the point where she couldn't take it anymore.
Right.
So I ended up selling my house, moving out in the county. And then after the case was over, the case ended and Byron Smith was tried and convicted for two counts of first degree murder and two counts of second degree murder, sentenced to life in prison because of what he did.
Good job, Jeremy. I've not met you in person, but I'm incredibly proud of your integrity.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. So I'm in my, and when the case was just ending, I had just sold my house moved out of my house in town and bought this other place out in the county to get away from all the harassment.
Wow.
So then 3 months after the case was over, you know, you think life would start to get back to normal. It did not. There was still the harassment, because the Byron Smith Coalition now was working hard to try to come up with more of a defense so that they could do an appeal.
Oh, okay.
So the harassment continued even after the case was over. My wife had her fill. She had enough. She couldn't take anymore. 3 months after the trial was over, I ended up moving out of my new house because my wife wanted a divorce.
Yeah.
So in the ultimate end, 17-year-old Nicholas Brady, 18-year-old Haley Kiefer lost their lives.
Right.
Byron Smith ended up losing his freedom, and I lost my family.
Oh, my God. Just so devastating all the way around.
It was. But it, because of my wife knew, too, that I would never give up my profession, my career as a law enforcement officer, because she knows how much I loved helping people. Still to this day, it was my true calling in life. My true passion is to help people.
So, but you are retired now from law enforcement.
From all the stress that I've dealt with in my job, I ended up and all the equipment and everything I had to wear and all the heavy lifting and all that stuff I had to do in and out of the squad car. I ended up with degenerative disc disease and I ended up with primary progressive MS. So,
oh my God. So you're struggling with MS right now?
Yes. Yes. Oh. In fact, I worked for 10 years when I was diagnosed with primary progressive MS. I still worked for 10 years. I didn't want to quit. I finally got to the point last year in the end of August. I was 48 years old at the time, and I had to retire. I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't do the job anymore because of my my physical disabilities now with MS. Yeah.
So what would you have to say to the listeners of my podcast that could be of use to them in a situation that you've been through?
The best thing you can do is keep your faith. You know, I always look ahead. I always keep a very positive, I've always had a very positive demeanor about myself. I always look on the bright side. So I always look on the bright side of things. I'm not a negative person at all. I'm always a very positive type of person. And so I always just, and my faith was always there to guide me and to help me. So keep your faith. That's the best thing. In my experience, it's the best thing I could ever do.
Have you lost your faith in humanity, even though you have faith in God? Have you lost your faith in your fellow man?
I have not. And you know what? After everything that's happened to me, I will not lose my faith in God or humanity. No. Okay. Because why? Because not everybody's like that. It's just certain people out there that, you know, that are like that. And I'm not one to hold a grudge. Never have been, never will be. So no, I never have lost my faith in humanity, and I never will, because I always have hope that they can learn from their mistakes, turn their lives around, look to the light of God, and become good people.
Has anybody apologized to you that really has come to understand that the error of their ways?
Yes, I've had actually reached other people and had them. And that's a very good question, because many a times when I'd be off work, I'd be in the grocery store. It's happened to me many times. I'm all shopping, and people that I have arrested for major felony crimes and answered for what they did would get out of jail, come up to me. And when they see me, they make it a point to beeline over to me to talk to me.
Right.
And I would love talking to them. And they tell me how their interaction with me, you know, changed their life. That they were able to learn from their mistake. They paid for their crime. They did, paid the price. And they would thank me because of the way I treated them. Killing them with kindness, teaching, treating them with respect that everybody deserves. They were very grateful. They come up and tell me, you changed my life. And it felt so good hearing that.
And what about some of the people that went after you because you wanted this case to be prosecuted? Did anybody apologize to you for their ignorance and their stupidity?
No, that they did not do. I have never received apology from any of them. But do I hold it against them? No. I refuse to hold anything bad against anybody. It's just, and why? It's because of my faith. The Lord's prayer. As we forgive those who trespass against us. I live by that. That is a pillar in my life.
Okay. And how about your relationship with your brother? How are things between the two of you at this point?
Excellent. It always has been, always will be. There is nothing that can shake our bond. No.
That is so sweet.
Yeah.
You know, again, you are so kind to share this story. I think that most people would have become so bitter and disillusioned by what it is that you've gone through. You're truly a remarkable human in terms of being able to retain your faith despite, seeing the worst in humanity on your job and then seeing the worst in humanity and the people that want to defend somebody who's a double murderer.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Dana. And talking with you about this and talking with other people about this is therapeutic for me. And it really is. And this is why I love telling the story. Because it's also helping me quite a bit too to get it out. And after I retired, I was able to, when I was working, I was able to mostly, lock away the bad things that I've seen in that. Right. What I discovered after I retired, that's when things actually start coming back to the surface. It made it definitely a little harder, but nothing I can't deal with.
Well, I will tell you, I've been a clinical psychologist for 35 years and treated a lot of people who have gone through trauma. And you are truly an inspiration, because it's so, so easy to become embittered and disillusioned and to really lose your faith in the face of the worst that humanity has to offer. I think your community is really lucky to have you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that, Dana.
Mm-hmm. So tell us again, what's the name of the book?
So the name of my book, and the reason I wrote this book, is it was very therapeutic for me to be able to get it out to the public and let people know what actually happened in this case, to let them understand why I did what I had to do. The name of the book is called Murder on Elm Street, A True Life Crime Story. It's on, it will be coming out in September of 2023. And it'll be, you can find it on Amazon.
Oh, good.
Okay. I also have a Facebook page that is called...
Tell us how to get to that.
Sure. All you got to do is go on Facebook, type in Murder on Elm Street, A True Life Story, take you right to the page. I have a lot of interesting information on there, and I will also update when the book will be available. And like I said, it should be available September of this year.
Yeah. And what do you think about the idea if people want to contact you? Are you comfortable? Is the best way to do that through Facebook?
Oh, sure. They can contact me on my Facebook page, or they can contact me on my email. My email is murderonelmstreet@gmail.com.
Okay.
So very easy to find. You know.
Very good. I'm just blown away.
Thanks, Dana. You have a wonderful show here. You've been very pleasant and wonderful to talk with. And I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to be on your show.
Well, I really want to know when the book comes out, because I want to promote it even further on my podcast and on my website and so on and so forth, because I think people need to hear how faith can carry you through the worst times in life. I speak a lot about that in my podcast and in my personal life. And I think that it is one of the key ingredients to living a fulfilling life.
I agree. So with you.
It's quite inspirational to hear your story.
Thank you.
I really want to thank you. And again, I hope that you'll get lots of feedback from this, from my listeners, and I really wish you the best. Thank you again.
Thank you, Dana. I appreciate it.
Okay.